Penguin Random House Audio presents When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end, by Diane Rehm. Read for you by the author and Susan Bennett, Dan Bittner, Jim Frangione, Kevin R. Free, Neil Heligers, Sarah Malo Christensen, Maggie Meg Reed, Suzanne Torin, and Benjamin Zied.
This book is dedicated first to the memory of my late husband, John Rehm. Our long marriage and his death have shaped my life. To my husband of 2 years, John Hagedorn, who has brought new joy into my life. Finally, to my beloved children, David and Jennifer Rehm, and their families.
Foreword by John Grisham. Not long after I finished law school and hung out my shingle, I was surprised one day to find a real prospective client in my office. Since I had so few visitors in those early weeks, I welcomed her to my quiet little cubbyhole and poured us some coffee. We eventually drank an entire pot. She was 50 years old, and her hard life had taken a tragic turn. Through tears and anger, she told me about her son, a young man in his 20s who had been permanently injured by incompetent doctors at a large hospital. At least that was her version. She described him as being brain dead, comatose, a vegetable, unable even to open his eyes, though he occasionally grunted and groaned as if in pain. His body could do little more than breathe, just enough to sustain him, so a respirator was not being used. She fed him through a tube. He weighed 80 pounds at his last checkup 2 years earlier. She had decided to skip any more visits to the doctor because she couldn't afford them. Besides, the doctor had given up. He told her that her son might possibly live for years in his condition. As a hungry lawyer, I had to suppress my excitement at the thought of snagging such a lucrative case, since I had no experience with medical malpractice or any other specialty for that matter. I knew I would have to associate with a skilled trial lawyer to negotiate a huge settlement. Imagine, barely out of law school and already hitting a grand slam. I admit that these greedy thoughts kept creeping into my mind as I poured coffee and listened to her. For the past 6 years, her son had been waiting to die. The entire family had been waiting, or what was left of it. Her husband had abandoned her when he realized their lives had been reduced to unpaid caregivers. Not a word from him in 2 years. An older daughter avoided them, too. She lived alone with her son in a small country house on 2 acres owned by her parents. Because she couldn't leave her son, she couldn't keep a job. They had no money, no income, no assets, and lived off the generosity of some neighbors and 2 small churches. During that long initial meeting, we never talked about a lawsuit. I was too shy to bring up the subject and didn't want to appear too eager. Plus, I figured we would get around to it sooner or later. She invited me to her home to meet her son and get a first-hand look at their plight. I have always wished I had declined. Larry lived in an old hospital bed, and if there were 80 pounds of him, I couldn't see it. He was a skeleton, gaunt, depleted, pasty white with shaggy hair. He hadn't left the room in 6 years. His mother had tucked the sheets up to his waist, and his bare chest hardly moved when he breathed. The feeding tube ran to a port in his stomach, just below his protruding ribs. I had expected to be shocked and saddened, and I was. But I was also dumbstruck and couldn't think of much to say. I couldn't force myself to bring up the lawsuit. She gently exposed the tube and added some formula to it. As she held it, she began crying and said, "So many times I've wanted to just pull this thing out and let him drift away. Let him go ahead and die with whatever dignity he has left. Wouldn't that be a good thing, Mr. Grisham?" There was no doubt the answer was yes. But I couldn't utter the word. And I reckon if I did pull out his tube and he died, then somebody might say something, and they'd have me up for murder. Don't you think, Mr. Grisham? I doubt that, I managed to say. It don't seem right keeping a person alive when they should die naturally. It's not right, I agreed. Not right at all. If you pulled that tube out, I wouldn't tell anyone, Mr. Grisham. I swear. I've wanted to many times, but I just can't do it to my boy. I should leave, I said. I needed fresh air, and I had suddenly lost interest in any lawsuit. As things turned out, there had been a trial, and not a successful one. The doctors and hospital hired the best legal talent money could buy, and the jury found in their favor. No negligence at all. Not a penny to the boy. I answered her calls for a few weeks, and she eventually went away. I don't know how long he lived. I hoped she had found the courage to remove his tube, but I doubted it. At the time, I was 26 years old. Newly married, with a pretty wife, a bright future, boundless energy. I was going places. I wasn't sure exactly where, but it didn't matter. We were young and healthy and dreaming of starting a family, of living the good life. All this to say, I was too busy living to stop for a second and think about the right to die. But in that one brief encounter with Larry, I became a believer. I prepared living wills and advanced directives for my wife and me, and for my parents and in-laws, and I hounded family members and friends and other clients to put their wishes in writing. My wife and I have made it clear to our two adult children that we intend to be in control of our own final days if at all possible, and that when the end is inevitable, we will not be sustained by machines or medications. When faced with a terminal illness or a sickness so debilitating that there is no quality of life, I want the right to die on my terms. How I choose to end my life should be of no concern to others. John Grisham, June 24th, 2019.
Preface. Death was part of my life at an early age. It's December 1955. My beautiful mother lies in a bed at Georgetown University Hospital, crying, moaning, suffering, begging for God to take her. For perhaps the sixth time, she has been drained of several quarts of fluid. Before each procedure, her stomach becomes severely distended, making her appear to be 9 months pregnant. I am alone as I watch her, feeling totally helpless, crying as I stroke her feet, unable to ease her pain, hating her suffering, hating that she has to continue living. She is 49 years old. I am 19. We are told she is suffering from cirrhosis of the liver, a disease ordinarily attributed to alcoholism. My mother is not an alcoholic. She and my father share a shot glass of whiskey on Christmas and New Year's Eve. The doctors are skeptical of her denials, but finally come to believe her. Had they asked me, I could have vouched for my mother's non-drinking habits. I knew she had suffered from malaria in her teenage years when she lived in Alexandria, Egypt. Whether that disease could have affected her liver to such an extent 40 years later, I cannot know. She lay in that hospital bed for weeks, her beautiful, unwrinkled skin and eyes yellowed with jaundice, the fluid continually mounting, swelling her belly again and again. December 31, 1955. My husband and I have just moved into our new apartment, several blocks from my parents' home. We
sample complete. Ready to continue?